Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Doing No Harm by Lama Adam Berner. Our lives are a process full of change and uncertainty. Forgetting this, we suffer. One method the Buddha taught to help us wake up to our situation was the commitment to doing no harm. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to the path. This is it, really. Our ultimate goal is to wake up, which is what Buddhahood means, to be fully awake. Awaken from the sleep of ignorance in particular. But the path to waking up is a gradual process. It takes a long time, probably. And as our awareness grows, our ignorance will invariably decrease. And we can wake up. When we do, we too will be Buddha. And that's what that means, to be awake. Therefore, we'll also be called Buddha, awakened one. But first, we need to wake up to how things are right now. And Kenpo Carter Rinpoche has said, in words that echo a lot of the great masters, he said, in order to attain liberation, the only thing you need to eliminate is this false imputation of inherent existence to experiences, this false imputation of absolute reality or truth. And he said, if things are recognized as interdependent, they cannot harm you, and there's no need to avoid them or attempt to cause them to cease. It is though our failure to recognize interdependence, our false imputation of the inherent existence of what we experience, as well as our false imputation of our own inherent existence, that makes us spin around in samsara. And he also said, we must come to realize that everything we experience is interdependent, like the images of a dream or the reflection in a mirror. And that experiences cannot and do not occur without the necessary causes and conditions. Nothing we experience, including ourselves, is an independent identity. That is the correct understanding of conventional reality, and that correct understanding will automatically diminish the false apprehension of inherent existence. So as Rinpoche said, we must come to realize that everything we experience is interdependent, like the images of a dream. That being the case, and us not being awakened just yet, how do we live the dream? So today we'll talk about one approach, which is doing no harm. Doing no harm is a way we can live the dream, a way we live happier, more awakened lives while here on the path, living in accord with our actual mode of existence as we gradually make our way towards full awakening. So recognizing that everything we experience is interdependent, like the images of a dream, what should we do or not do in response to this dream? How do we react to it? That's really what we'll be discussing. As always, I would encourage you to recall and utilize the three stages of practice: listening, contemplating, and meditation. Throughout the presentation, I'd encourage you to simply listen, meaning allow yourself to be open to new information. Simply be open and attentive. You may feel an urge to react to things I'm saying, and you can react in any number of ways, but they'll probably all be some sort of analysis or comparison or contemplation. And I'd encourage you, for your own benefit, to simply notice those reactions and return your attention to the flow of information. Then when we have time for questions at the end, but more importantly later tonight, tomorrow and beyond, then I would encourage you to contemplate what you've heard today. Many of us have such an interest in thinking through things, analyzing and testing, and this is a very important step. But in order to accurately analyze something, we need the purest data possible, information untainted by our own opinions, projections, and fears, etc. Hearing new information that's challenging or appealing or seemingly unimportant, like meeting with any situation at all that's challenging, appealing, or seemingly unimportant, will undoubtedly trigger certain habitual strategies for us. Strategies that may seem to have some utility at some point in our lives, but then gradually they just became reactive tendencies, mindless impulse. So if you, like me, have a strong desire to analyze what you're hearing, I encourage you to treat the talk itself as your data collection time, with the understanding that you will absolutely use that data for the real analytical work that needs to be done, which is your own contemplation. But that contemplation should occur after the talk and beyond. That's when you need to do your own testing in your laboratory, as the Buddha himself implored us to do. Contemplation is essential to integrating these teachings, but it's vital we don't mix our listening and our contemplation too much. A little bit's inevitable, but let's try to weight things towards openness and being fully present during a teaching, with the understanding that we will absolutely engage in contemplation afterwards. The contemplation is perhaps more important to our own development, but if we want to get the most out of it, we need to listen purely first. And then the most important step is meditation. We have to maintain some daily practice of meditation. Even just 5 minutes of calm abiding meditation a day is of benefit. And in our meditation, we allow all the waves of conceptuality from our listening and our contemplative stages to recede back into the limitless ocean of awareness that is our true nature. Those waves of conceptuality arose from that ocean of awareness. They were never separate from it, and they inevitably return to it. And when they do, we have not lost them. So in our meditation, we allow those waves of conceptuality to recede, resting our mind as we've been trained with no more engagement in analysis or contemplation. We simply allow our meditation to occur. We get out of the way and we let it happen. So before we begin with the intention of fully waking up, let us generate bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, with the aspiration that our time here today will be a benefit to all sentient beings. We'll say the prayer of refuge 3 times, once in Tibetan, once in English, and once again in Tibetan. And while we chant the beautiful Tibetan melody, let's be sure to recall the meaning of what we're chanting. In particular, from this moment forward, we will only seek protection in ways and from the sources that will do no harm to others or ourselves, because that is the path by which true happiness can be attained. O sanje chudan suki chudnam la janchu padu dagni kyapsuchi dagi jin suki pe sunam ki drola penchi sangye drupashu. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Sangye chidang suki chodnam la janchu padu dagni kyapsuchi dagi jin suki pe sunam ki Drola penchi sangye drupashu. Aden sawe lama rinpoche daki chiwa pete denjula kadun shabu gone je sunte kusun tukingyo jubsa du so. And let's start with just a couple minutes of meditation. So if you are familiar with shamatha, just practice some shamatha. If not, just place your attention gently on the breath. And as you notice thoughts and sounds and sensations enter your field of experience, just notice them and bring your attention back to the breath. And we'll do that for about 5 minutes. Thinking of our life and the passage of time and our experience itself as being like a river is a common analogy. And there's good reason for that. First of all, like a river, we are a process, constantly in motion. A river flows and it picks things up along the way. It accumulates. Sometimes a tree branch will be swept away only to be deposited miles away. So it accumulates and it relinquishes. It rises and it falls. Similarly, we're in motion in terms of apparent spatial and temporal movement, but also in terms of seeming accumulation of memories, experiences, tendencies, and if we're lucky, some beneficial practice along the way. We also experience the fruition of past karma and sometimes leave behind old opinions and habits. We also leave behind physical capabilities we used to have as we age. What we think of as a self is an ever-changing collection, just like a river is always made up of different water. If we took a snapshot of one bend in a river, the water in our picture and much of what was in it will be gone just a short while later. But we still agree to call whatever water was in that specific place at any given time the river. We're talking about an entirely different set of water, but we still find some basic utility in calling it a river. We give a single conceptual title to something that is an ever-changing collection because there is some usefulness in being able to talk about that particular kind of collection in that particular place. And it's a similar situation with each of us and who we and others think we are. Impermanence is the actual state of things. And in our own experience, that translates as uncertainty, an ever-present, though rarely noticed, sense of groundlessness. Even though it is the actual state of things, when we do unexpectedly meet with a strong sense of that groundlessness, a strong reminder of our actual state, the most common reaction is to resist it and to distract ourselves from it via acting out in some way or another or through actively repressing our emotions. And in those ways, we ignore our true nature and the true nature of everything. We put ourselves further to sleep in a moment when we have the greatest potential to wake up. Now, a talk like this is a little different because we usually come here expecting to hear about groundlessness. So our expectation of hearing about groundlessness is met, and that is ironically comforting ground, right? We've prepared ourselves for a mental journey into the concepts of non-conceptuality. That occurs, and we can, if we're not careful, walk away feeling even more fixated on our self-concepts. I, myself, am someone who likes to learn about no self. It's as if, from a brief examination of the general concept of impermanence and interdependence, we can generate and then cling to a vague, deceptive brand of false certainty. And that helps us to paper over our reactivity, our resistance to the actual groundless state of things. The only thing we can count on is change, feels kind of empowering to say, and to distract ourselves with. But if we really meant it, how much more empowering would it actually be? But the problem is we haven't really realized it. Talking about it and thinking about it, hoping we can always understand it, those are important steps, but at some point we need to recognize that what we cling to in these situations is frequently some kind of distraction. It's a manifestation of our ignorance. We really don't like to be reminded of life's uncertainty unless it's on our own predetermined terms. Rather than being present with the many instances of simple groundlessness found throughout every single day, we tend to divert into concepts and ideas. We divert into thinking. That's not to say that we cannot one day wake up and realize our full Buddha potential, and thereby embrace both groundlessness and its myriad manifestations. In the long term, that is absolutely our goal, and it is achievable. But we have to be ready for the long journey to that final goal, and a potentially quite long path towards full awakening. In the short term, day to day and moment to moment, our primary mission is to do everything we can to become more skillful at working with reality as we experience it. And we do experience it as a mix of conceptual understanding about groundlessness, punctuated by frequent unsettling upswells of resistance to that very groundlessness. Moment to moment, we're either waking up or we're going to sleep. And perhaps counterintuitively, going to sleep takes a lot more effort than waking up. Why? Because of our reactivity. We keep thinking we need to react to every instance of groundlessness in our lives. And those reactions of acting out and repression are exhausting. They burden us with so much avoidable discomfort. In order to wake up, rather than consistently or constantly reacting, There are methods for just relaxing into the natural state. It is perhaps counterintuitively a lot less work to wake up than it is to go to sleep. But we need to know how. And one way the Buddha taught was through the three commitments, or the three vows. And there's a parallel here with the famous four lines: do no harm, practice only virtue, tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. These three lines summarize the entirety of the Buddha's teaching. And what the Buddha taught was how stuff works. That's what the Dharma means. It's just the way things are. So as Kenpo Ken Holmes put it, it may sound quite exotic to us to say that the Buddha taught the Dharma, but it's really as simple as saying the one who was awake taught how things are. He was awake to the actual state of things and shared what he knew. And all the complexity of his teachings, all the vast and deep Dharma, can be summed up in those lines: do no harm, practice only virtue, tame your mind. That is the teaching of the Buddha. And there's a particular vow associated with each of those lines. For Pema Chodron's book, Living Beautifully with Change and Uncertainty, which is my primary source for today's talk, she summarized them as committing to do no harm, committing to take care of one another, and committing to embrace the world just as it is. The first of this is traditionally called the Pratimoksha vows. That's the vow to do no harm. It's also called the vow of personal liberation. And these vows help us to reduce our negative impact on ourselves and others through teaching us clearly what we should refrain from doing and familiarizing us with what it feels like to refrain in a beneficial way. The second commitment, committing to take care of one another, is traditionally called the Bodhisattva vow, which teaches us what there is to be done and how to do it most beneficially. And the third commitment, committing to embrace the world just as it is traditionally called the Samaya vow, which teaches us to meet everything we encounter as a manifestation of awakened energy, and also as the essential means of awakening further. Today we'll be talking about the first of these, which is the commitment to do no harm. We've already discussed a bit about our habitual reactivity and how it's impeding our ability to wake up to the ever-present groundless nature. Instead of resting in the actual state of things, the positive aspect of uncertainty and groundlessness, we create and tend to cling to an illusion that comfort and security are the natural state. Under that erroneous assumption, whenever we don't find ourselves feeling perfectly comfortable and secure, we react as if something has gone horribly wrong. All of our attention shifts away from authentic engagement with the present moment, meaning being awake, and instead we pick up a hopeless effort at eliminating uncertainty and discomfort. Of course, that has never worked, which is why it keeps coming back. It's tragic, really. It's the actual state of things is uncertainty, and that doesn't have to be negative. But because we haven't come to grips with how things really are, we're uncomfortable whenever we meet with the actual state of things. And then we try to ignore that discomfort with the reactivity of acting out or repressing, rather than getting at what's really the heart of the matter, which is simply...
I'm still not sure about that.
She's the best. Me neither. which is simply waking up to the way things are. Uncertainty is not the problem. Interdependence is not the problem. Delayed packages, incorrect fast food orders, traffic is not the problem. Our resistance to fundamental groundlessness is the problem. As I said earlier, many of us, myself included, have a strong desire to figure stuff out, to find the answers. We feel restless and uneasy until we've reassured ourselves that we've finally got it figured out. But we can never really say we have it all figured out. That feeling of, this is the answer, finally, is itself a distraction whenever we cling to it. When we do get that kind of a feeling, that can be what we call fundamentalism. It's manufacturing a conceptual monument like an edifice that we cling to as being the truth, even when it runs contrary to what's actually always a state of uncertainty. Fundamentalism comes from a fixed sense of identity, fixation to the idea that we are a certain kind of person. When such and such happens, I react such and such way. I'm justified in being upset because I don't like it when. I'm just the kind of person who doesn't like blank. When we're fixated on our identity, we become obsessed with rearranging our world to fit our creation, our illusion. And meditation is a vital part of dismantling our creation in a healthy way. It can be challenging because so much of our time up to now has been dedicated to the opposite, reinforcing our creation. Think about how much of your day, your activity, and your reactivity is dedicated to making the world complement your own illusion of a self. Through karma, habit, and repetition, we've trained ourselves to find challenges to our fixed identity unpleasant, and reinforcement of it pleasant. And that's a learned metric. It's not a universal truth. Think about the people you enjoy being around. If you think you're a nice person and you meet people that think you're a nice person, it's fun to be around those people. If you think you're a clear speaker and you meet people and they don't understand what you're saying, they don't get the meaning of what you're saying, not as nice to be around them. Doesn't fit with the fixed identity. Our feelings of discomfort when our identity is challenged, our name for that is shenpa in Tibetan. And a shenpa is a sense of getting hooked. It can be a physical sensation as well as a mental experience. And looking for that physical sensation is important in getting to know shenpa. It can get triggered in an instant, like when we turn a corner and there's a traffic jam, or there's a dirty microwave in the office break room, construction next door when we're trying to do our meditation practice. Working with shenpa can be a lot like the mindfulness practices which have been developed for pain management. In those methods, instead of trying to distract from the pain, we actually place our attention upon the pain. And these can be very effective methods. And the key is we don't get involved with the stories or the opinions about the pain. We simply open to the experience. And that's ironically been shown to have dramatic decrease in the perceived discomfort of pain. And we can work with shenpa in the same way. When we feel some kind of disturbance to our comfort and security, an upheaval of strong energy, instead of retreating into distraction and stories, we can simply open ourselves to the sensation, the feeling. It can be challenging, but making a concerted effort to simply be with that felt sensation of shenpa can rapidly transform our experience of it. It's difficult. This is a really difficult practice, but each time we even try, we loosen our fixation on self-identity, and we lessen the momentum towards reactivity. And it can help us see that it was never really that energy itself that was the problem. It was our stories about it. The problem wasn't even so much our getting hooked as it was our staying hooked. Science has shown that the biochemical mechanism triggered by a strong emotion lasts 90 seconds. We meet with something that upsets us, and 90 seconds later, the physiological mechanism of that strong emotion has run its course. Is that your experience? Think about that, because we need to really examine that, right? Like, science has shown that the biochemical mechanism triggered by strong emotion lasts only 90 seconds. We meet with something that upsets us, and 90 seconds later, the physiological mechanism of that strong emotion has run its course. We may want to believe it, and why not? We're inclined to believe it's true because it would give us some comfort. Think about the last time something upset you. Did it go away in 90 seconds? More importantly, when something upsets you, what were you doing 90 seconds later? That's important to think about because it's what we're doing 90 seconds after the upsetting stimuli that determines whether we're still feeling the mental and physical effects of it. So we're very limited in our ability to control external phenomena, but we have vast untapped powers of impacting our internal world. When something outside of our control upsets us, how do we react? Do we even need to react? And if, before we put much conscious thought into it, we do happen to react, do we need to continue to react? This 90-second rule was in Pema Chodron's book, and I wanted to look it up and see if it was like just in Pema Chodron's book. But of course it's out there, and there's a number of articles about it. This was in Psychology Today, the article. It said, scientists say that constant reaction to things beyond our control not only creates misery, but it also shortens our lives. Chronic reactivity creates a stressful biochemical boomerang that weakens the immune system and increases the likelihood of a heart attack or a stroke. Seems like it's something worth working on. So what do we do with strong emotions that's so unproductive? It's that we run away from them. We react to them by acting out or repressing. And the acting out could be external speech or behavior, or it could just be a mental monologue of blame, victimhood, shock, injustice. We take an escape route from our real, authentic selves in that moment. The moments when, in fact, we could truly meet with our groundless nature right then. Those are the moments we could choose to wake up. In this way, it's not that we get distracted from a genuine experience of the present moment by an emotion. Instead, what happens is that we get distracted from the genuine experience of the moment into a story. So to the commitment aspect of this, the do no harm aspect. So a commitment in this context means a clearly set intention, meaning knowing what we're vowing. And this helps us to interrupt blind reactivity, forcing us to think. That's an essential step on the path to be fully awake. The commitment to do no harm is traditionally made with the pratimoksha vows, or the vow of personal liberation. This frees from the suffering of resisting our actual situation, groundlessness. Helps us to see our habitual escape routes from the present moment. It helps us to decide not to take those well-worn off-ramps from the now. We should notice and take stock of our off-ramps from reality. This is a powerful way of getting to know ourselves. Commitment to do no harm helps us to refrain from harmful speech and actions. There's four main commitments called the root precepts. Those are not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, and not to harm anyone with our sexual expression. And then there's a fifth branch precept, which is not to take intoxicants, because in those circumstances, it's easier to break the first four, the main precepts. Pema Chodron says, following the precepts gives us a space to examine every nuance of the urge to express ourselves negatively, and then, while fully acknowledging our feelings, make the choice to not do anything that could cause harm. Both acting out and repression can be harmful to ourselves and others. Refraining causes space for us to see our habitual reactivity clearly. We see it arise, we can watch it abide, and we may even see it subside. It's a practice of being present with the upswell of energy and our habitual urge to react. And it's not easy, but it's easier than one might think. When we engage with a practice like this, we have to maintain an attitude of compassionate self-reflection. Through this, we'll begin to see that we aren't bad people, but fundamentally good people who happen to have some habits that are causing us an awful lot of suffering. This allows a positive desire to get to know these habits better so we can begin to reduce and eliminate them. Reactivity strengthens negative emotions, which strengthens our illusion of self-identity, our fixation. Refraining reflectively allows us to connect with fundamental uncertainty. That edgy, restless energy is what Pema Chodron called it. It allows us to connect with that edgy, restless energy without bailing out, without pulling a ripcord. And I want to read a string of verses here from the Bodhicharavatara, the way of the Bodhisattva, that relates to what we're talking about. And when you feel the wish to move about or even to express yourself in speech, first examine what is in your mind, for steadfast ones should act correctly. When the urge arises in your mind to feelings of desire or angry hate, do not act. Be silent, do not speak, and like a log of wood, be sure to stay. And when your mind is wild or filled with mockery or filled with pride and haughty arrogance, or when you would expose another's secret guilt to bring up old dissensions or to act deceitfully, or when you want to fish for praise or criticize and spoil another's name, or use harsh language sparring for a fight, it's then that like a log you should remain. And when you yearn for wealth, attention, fame, a circle of retainers serving you, and when you look for honors, recognition, it's then that like a log you should remain. And when you are inclined to overlook another's need and want to get the best thing for yourself, and when you feel the urge to speak, it's then that like a log you should remain. Impatience, indolence, faint-heartedness, and likewise arrogance and careless speech, attachment to your side, when these arise, it's then that like a log you should remain. Examine thus yourself from every side. Take note of your defilements and your pointless efforts. For thus the heroes of the Bodhisattva path seize firmly on such faults with proper remedies. With perfect and unyielding faith, with steadfastness, respect, and courtesy, with conscientiousness and awe, work calmly for the happiness of others. So the three commitments are not a teaching about morality. They are a highly effective method for waking up to our actual situation and making the deep changes necessary to stay awake. The skill of noticing our escape routes and not taking them is a necessary precursor to the other two commitments, the commitment to take care of one another and the commitment to embrace the world just as it is. The commitment to doing no harm is the narrow way because it has clear guardrails for keeping us on the path. In short, we do not speak or act out, period. Or, like a log, you should remain. Strong habits are hard to break, and no one would deny that. But if we're going to work on the strong habits, we have to begin in the easiest possible situations. In other words, we have to begin lifting the lightest weights if we ever hope to lift the heaviest ones. And that means starting with the little annoyances and the little things that don't fit our preferences. We have to start working with those if we expect vast improvements on big changes and big surprises, loss and death, and these things that we're all going to face in various ways. We kind of think we could put those off, working about with those things and dealing with them. But they always come around, and it's usually not, you know, it's not on our terms. So when you leave here today and something doesn't fit your preferences, like, that's really your chance to work. I mean, there's a quote, let's see if I can put this in the best terms. When it's time to use the bathroom, it's too late to build the outhouse. That's why we need to work with in these little instances every single day. They're all gifts. Some people may question it, if I'm simply not doing something, like if I'm not killing, why do I actually have to take a vow not to? And there's a difference between simply not doing something and making a vow not to do it. Pema Chodron says that outer renunciation is what happens when we simply refrain from something without holding a vow. But when we make a vow to not do something, such as not speak harshly, we not only outwardly refrain, but we inwardly commit to being present with the uneasiness of our energy. We commit to getting to know what that feels like, both the urge to speak or act and the urge to repress can feel quite strong, and yet we train in simply being present with them and not running for the exits. The precepts themselves can be taken in a formal ceremony with a preceptor, such as a lama who holds the vows, but perhaps more importantly, one can take all, a few, or even just one of the vows anytime one chooses. For instance, on one of the great occasions of the Buddha's life, the four Buddhist holidays we celebrate throughout the year, would be ideal days to take and hold the vows. Or any full or new moon days would also be quite auspicious. But any day is a good day to practice with some of these vows. Or perhaps you'd like to try a week. Any engagement at all with these vows is good practice, and I encourage you to try them on yourself in whatever way you think you're capable. Being certain to engage in both the outer renunciation, prescribed by whichever precept you choose, and the inner renunciation of committing to stay present with how you feel and how that feels to refrain. Outer renunciation alone can be a path of pride, showing off, and therefore even furthering self-deception, putting us more to sleep rather than waking up. That's why it's so important that we commit to doing the inner work that goes along with outer renunciation. So our renunciation actually has more power when we feel the pull towards speaking or acting out. Think of a situation where you really wanted to speak or act out, and maybe you even did. But with the feeling of that situation in mind, try to simply be present with the idea of refraining from acting. Don't bury the feeling or repress it. Just examine it. This kind of practice can really start to give us some insight in what's coming, you know, in the future for us to be able to handle situations more skillfully. You may want, if you do this kind of a practice, to actually write down ways that you thought of to escape, ways that you've used or thought of before. It's just for you, but if you write them down and set them somewhere, then you can kind of remind yourself what your tendencies are and where your escape routes that you usually go for, where they're located. The uneasiness of refraining and the inner renunciation work is something we're going to have to work with for a while. It's not only a little bit like withdrawal that smokers go through, it is withdrawal. Pema Chodron even refers to it as a detox period. But it is this very uneasiness that will gradually transform into an experience of our basic goodness. That uneasiness and that uncertainty is what we're trying to connect to, not what we need to run away from. And a great place to start with all of this is just basic meditation. The meditation we teach on Sundays here at 10 a.m., intro to meditation class. That practice is the foundation of everything. It is a practice of refraining. You know, we sit down, and first of all, we're not doing anything else. And then we sit with our minds. We sit there, and things happen. We can choose to follow them, take off, or we can stay with our support, generally the breath. What we take off into is thinking and concepts. And so that's another way we can practice day to day, just picking a support, whatever thing we're doing. We could just do that. And there's a lot of reasons why we feel pulled to do 3, 4, or 5 things at once. But there's really no multitasking. It doesn't really happen. And if we can take some time to consciously put our attention in one place, whether it's the dishes or walking or even just sitting and feeling the pressure of our body on a chair, that can be a support. Just place our attention there, and when we notice thinking, we bring our attention back. The same thing happens when we feel uneasiness. You know, we can actually place our attention on that feeling. And it is hard. It's maybe the hardest practice. And it's kind of what Lama Tom and Lama Kathy and I and everyone who's done a 3-year retreat, that's kind of what the whole thing is working with those types of situations. Like, how do you work with emotion, you know, thought? And that's really it, you know? Just put your attention on it. Like I said, you'll get pulled away real fast. The gravity is towards getting pulled into concepts and ideas, but that's okay. You know, you just bring your attention back. And it's the same thing we do in shamatha. It's the same thing that you do from your first meditation lesson, you know? Just bring the attention back. So those vows, just for informational purposes, not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to harm anyone with sexual expression, and not to take intoxicants. And you can try any one of those on your own. You don't even have to tell anybody you're doing it. So that's all the information I have. So does anyone have any questions?
Hi.
Hi.
Can you speak on skillful conflict resolution? And do we have to go through this detox period before we can skillfully resolve conflict?
Can I stay there for just a moment so I can think about it? So, like if you're in an active conflict with someone.
Yeah.
And then you're saying, so like, do you have to like sit with that feeling, that discomfort before you speak?
Yeah, I guess when I'm imagining it, it may be an awkward conversation if you take... It may be an awkward conversation if you pause to say what you really feel. So.
Well, now I've got something to say. That's good. So I think that's really... The pause is such a good thing. Like, okay. And I think a really simple practice right away is noticing that, like, when you really feel like you have to say something, that's probably not a good time to say anything. That's usually when you've got that strong urge to speak, that means that, you know, you're probably not going to speak in the wisest ways. Mm. But then you have another party there, right? Mm. And they may expect you to say something. So it is, if you have a kind of relationship with the person where you can discuss in advance the idea that, like, when there's strong emotions, maybe we could just take a break and revisit later. Mm. I'm pulling straight from like when I was in therapy as a kid, you know, like it was like we talked about the timeout, you know, and I think that's one of the best ideas in relationships is if you have the kind of close relationship where you can agree that when things get heated and someone says timeout, that's not a shut up, you know, that's a listen, I'm losing control of my ability to be skillful. We need a break and then we'll revisit. But you have to revisit, you know. Mm. But so I think if you can ask someone to take a break, there's really nothing that needs to be said right away, ever. I always joke about the only thing that you have to say right away is look out. You know, like anything else can wait, you know, and probably should. And then you can take the time, you know, to rest on that feeling, you know. Just put the attention on the feeling. And then as you do that, like, well, first of all, 90 seconds. So if you can really skillfully do that, which is tough, you know, theoretically, more, if you're consciously trying, it'll be quicker, you know, that you can get the, you know, the fight or flight response to calm down and things like that. But I think in conflict, it's tricky because there's a lot of, There's concepts happening there too, right? Because there's the concepts that like a conversation has to continue. I mean, it's funny how like our urge to not sit quietly in a room with someone also like blows up into the situation where like if someone's yelling, you have to respond. Because there's just this like sense of like rhythm that has to continue. And that's just one of our habitual tendencies, you know? But if you can start to interrupt that, and that's why I brought up like a close, intimate relationship, because it takes some real trust for somebody to like understand that you putting a break or a pause on a conversation is not like a power move. It's not like a hate thing. It's like a we need to protect each other in this moment kind of a thing. And the best way we could do that is to take a little break and cool down and then come back. And maybe that is exactly what we're talking about. Maybe that is that idea of pausing, and you have to, at that point, stop thinking about, you know, whatever the subject of the argument was, or whatever the subject of the, you know, the conflict was in the first place, you know, because you wouldn't want to take a break from something like that and then spend the time stewing about how right you were, right? So, yeah, it's a tricky question. Like, in the midst of a strong conflict, what do you do? Yeah, I think the best option is, if you can, be like a log, you know?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Morning.
Good morning.
I just have a couple comments. One, my first teacher, Lama Yeshe, during one of his teachings, he stopped and he said, I don't really want you to believe what I'm saying. I want you to remember it for future contemplation and for recognizing it when you have that experience sometime in the future. The other thing is, I've been very incentivized to not to do harm by being really aware of the results of my doing harm, both the immediate feeling that I had when that happened, but also to kind of watch. And it really requires a lot of honesty with oneself to accept the responsibility for what befalls me as a result of that harm that I did. So, once I learned to be aware of these things happening and to be aware of my role in them happening, it really, really, really improved my motivation for not doing harm. So, but that's, you know, it takes a long, like you said, you know, a lot of meditation to become sensitized enough to the present moment to appreciate these things unfolding in my life. So,
yeah,
that's okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, that to say a little bit about that too, I mean, their discomfort's tricky, right? And our habits are tricky. Like, we don't like being around discomfort, and so much of the good things that we could do for ourselves are a little uncomfortable, you know? I mean, just basic stuff like eating right and exercising, you know, like those are great examples, but it's the same thing with like not, you know, trying to act out of ego. You know, someone says something, it rubs you a little wrong, like you don't have to react, but that same discomfort, you know, is kind of the thing. Like we kind of on some conceptual level know what would help us, but we get wrapped up with this discomfort. We give it so much power. And an interesting concept is that the more we try to maintain our comfort, the smaller a zone we can actually be comfortable in, you know? We actually shrink the amount of space in which we can be comfortable the more time we spend being comfortable. We get more specific in our needs and our desires and our requirements, you know? So, Pema Chodron has a really great diagram with like three concentric circles, and she calls the middle one the comfort zone, and the one outside that the learning zone, and the one outside that the excessive risk zone. And the idea is that we want to spend as much time as possible in the learning zone. But the reason there's three zones here is because sometimes we do need to honor our need to get back to our comfort zone. You know, like we all have like a certain capability of where we're at, and we need to be pushing that capability. But if we stay in that learning zone too long, we can get into the excessive risk zone, you know, where things could not be productive anymore. So we need to start to become aware of when we're just chilling, you know, in the comfort zone, or when we've strayed into that excessive risk zone. But in any case, we should be trying to stay outside of our comfort zone just a bit, you know, because again, like, that's the small weights that we're lifting for when the big ones come along and we have to pick those up. You know, like, we need to get as much practice as possible in every possible way. And really simple advice on some, I mean, the commitments is a good way to work with that. Another thing is just try to do stuff different. I mean, it sounds so silly, but like, use a different cup in the morning, you know? Drive a different way to work. You know, like, there's all these little simple ways that we can start to push outside our comfort zone. And then each little one of those things we do makes it easy to do more. And then we can also start to get creative. And then it becomes like a game. It can actually be fun, you know? So, yeah, I think that related to what Tim was saying, you know, like, we do need to know the results of what we're doing. But there's simple ways to work with just getting ready for when those circumstances arise, you know? Any other questions?
Thanks, Lama Adam. I really enjoyed that talk. I've always been fascinated. I think it was one of the early aspects of teachings that I was exposed to that drew me to Buddhism, is sort of the idea of the possibility of transforming obstacle to fuel, right? Mm. And I feel like I picked up again, you know, the seed of that idea in your talk today. And I liked what you said about how much of your retreat seemed to be perhaps dedicated to this, sort of, you know, not as simple as returning to the breath always, but you know, how to work with thoughts and emotions. And just lately, I've had this sense of things in my practice where, like, my kleshas are such well established, you know, my neurotic patterns are so established that when I bump into one of them, it's almost like a familiar feeling in my head, you know, like my impulse to be vindictive, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. It's like, you know, it's such a worn path that there it is, right? But this idea of sort of noticing that, right, it can almost, if I'm hearing you right, it can almost be in and of itself the reminder to come back, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so, yay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad I appreciate you adding to my sense of and understanding that today. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's great. And that is, I think that's kind of related to what I was saying about how, you know, when you have the sense of wanting to speak out and you're trying to refrain from doing that, it makes it more powerful. Like, so noticing those habits and tendencies and things like that and not, you know, feeling their pull but not giving in to them, you know, that is strength. It's building real strength and really waking up. And another thing that was, I think, built into what you were saying is this idea that, like, when we notice we're distracted, like, again, to bring it back to shamatha, when we notice that we're having a thought or we aren't placing our attention on the breath, that's not a bad thing. Like, that's our awareness. And that's literally the whole path is building our awareness. And as our awareness grows, we see more and more of the things that we don't need to do. We see more and more the kleshas. We see more and more our distractions. We see more and more our mistakes, you know. We're going to see more of them and more clearly as our awareness develops. And that's great. That's actually great. And so that's why we give that very simple instruction with shamatha. Just come back, you know. It's not, you know, kick yourself and then come back. It's gently, patient, with patience and humor, just come back, you know? That's, and it's a good thing. So, yeah, thank you for that. We are out of time, but I really appreciate everybody listening today. Thank you. I If I made any mistakes, I confessed them. They were completely my own. I want to say that I rejoice in all of our teachers and all your good works, all your practice. I request all of our teachers to remain, to continue to teach. And with all of that in mind, let's do these two verses of dedication. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thank you. Have a great week.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.